This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
You're with ABC Radio National. I'm Claudia Taranto. And on Hindsight today, Martin Hewitson looks back at the life of Sir Hubert Opperman. He was a champion cyclist before the war and a Liberal Party politician who made a big contribution to the demise of the White Australia policy in the 1960s. I hope you enjoy Alle Oppie.
So Floyd Landis is crowned the winner of the 2006 Tour de France. The 59-second margin over Oscar Pereiro is the smallest in 17 years. While Cadel Evans and Michael Rogers can look back on a memorable tour, both Aussies finishing in the top 10.
The Tour de France is the most famous cycle race in the world. But before Cadel Evans and Michael Rogers, there was Hubert Opperman. Oppie, as he's better known, who died in 1996, was the first Australian to make an impression on the European cycling scene and won a string of endurance races in Europe and Australia during the 1920s and 30s. He was the first Australian to be highly placed in the Tour de France, the only Australian to win the prestigious Bol d'Or, to win the Paris-Brest Paris race, and still the only Australian to be voted European Sportsman of the Year. Yet for people outside of cycling's small fraternity, his name is virtually unknown. On today's programme, we look back at the life of the cyclist Australians called Oppie, and the French, Le Phenomenon. Oppie was born in Rochester, Victoria, in 1904. His father was a butcher by trade, but restless by nature, and the family moved endlessly around the country while his father prospected for that elusive seam of gold. Eventually, to give his life some stability, Oppie was taken in to be raised by his grandmother in the village of Melton.
I was at Melton. I learned to ride a bicycle at Melton. I can remember looking at the lads who were fortunate enough to own bicycles, and I managed to cajole a Scots migrant named Blake to loan me his machine, and he also loaned me his assistance for half a day to learn to ride it. I wasn't immediately a good balancer. It took me a full half day before I mastered it, and it was only my enthusiasm and my early attraction for it that I think enabled me to survive the bruises and the falls that I had. But I was determined, and so I learned to ride a bicycle there.
Ian Opperman, Oppie's son, takes up the story.
He left his grandmother and went to work as a delivery boy. Actually, he was working for Australia Post, and he was a telegraph boy. And he used to tell me that he would ride as fast as he could to try and beat particular trams that were going up streets, and that he could deliver and still pass the tram again. And I think that became in his nature, a competitive thing. And from then, he won the Australian Junior Cadet Cycling Under 17 when he was that age. And I think that gave him a start that he never, you know, wanted ever to be beaten.
I was always interested in cycle competition without knowing that such a thing existed. I knew little of cycle racing. I knew that there were bicycle races, and my dad actually took me to the exhibition on one what was termed ANA Day, now Australia Day. As he had done some cycling, he was interested to go along to the exhibition. He took me there, and we saw track racing. I saw track racing for the first time, and I was fascinated, and I induced him to stop for the evening's racing as well, and that was the spark that set me alight as far as competition was concerned. I managed to get hold of a second-hand bicycle and won my first bicycle race on the Moorabbin Road, a 10 miles event, and then shortly afterwards the senior cadet championship.
He used to tell me that he'd go for a training ride from Melbourne to Queensland. And some of the stories that he told me were those that in those days, in the 1920s and 30s, there weren't that many bridges. So he used to catch ferries. And the ferrymen he'd chat to would be people who were 70 years of age, and they would have been born in the 1850s. And he said he got some wonderful insight of Australian bush and folklore.
So then I became more ambitious and entered for the 80-mile cycle traders event. It turned out to be a wet day as well, and it's a hard race. And as we came to the finish, six of us sprinting, a motor car ran right through the centre of us. The bunch split, and I finished third. And then that was a Malvern Star bicycle for the prize for third. And I went up and to meet the owner of Malvern Star, I just knew vaguely as Bruce Small. But he had a magnetic personality. We had a long discussion, and I decided to ride a Malvern Star, and he would sell the bicycle for me that I'd won as a prize. And from there on, an association commenced, which lasted until his death in 1980, an association of 60 years of friendship and business association, which I had a fantastic effect on my career, and I think was of some value to him as well on the business side.
He became very, very close to Bruce Small. Now, Sir Bruce became his manager, and he became more like a father figure and probably took the place of his father.
With Bruce Small's guidance and support, Oppie left the post office and started to work for Malvern Star Cycles in Melbourne, where he concentrated all his efforts on improving his cycling skills. During the next 7 years, he won the Launceston Hobart Road Race three times, the 658-mile Dunlop Grand Prix, the Cycle Traders 100, and also collected the 24-hour world unpaced record. With these wins under his belt, it was decided in 1928 that the time was right for him to try winning the most famous of all cycling events, the Tour de France. An enthusiastic public raised £1,250 to send an Australian team of four over to France. Apart from Oppie, there was Ernie Bainbridge, Percy Osborne and Harry Watson. Rupert Guinness is a senior sports reporter for the Daily Telegraph and has covered many tours.
When they first went over there for the 1928 Tour de France, the Australians arrived, four of them arrived, after a long, long trip, seven-week boat trip from Perth.
Of course, you know, it wasn't easy going. He had to get on the rollers and cycling away. I mean, he told me that this woman came up to him whilst he was on the deck of the ship on the rollers and pedalling furiously, trying to keep his fitness up. And she said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm providing electricity for this ship." And she said, "Oh, we'll keep up the good work."
And then from Toulon in the south of France, there was another long train trip up to Paris. And by the time they got to Paris, the four of them were bunked up in a very modest accommodation as such. It was at a sort of a velodrome centre outside of Paris, which was where they lived, was just in a little loft at the very top. And while all the other French cyclists, amateurs and professionals around there were having, you know, they had all the good conditions, the good food, the good beds, they had the heaters and things like that. The Aussies who lived up in this little bunk, they had no fresh water, the toilets weren't there, they had crappy beds. They were very much the impoverished Aussies up there, and they weren't rated very highly at all. Their bikes were regarded as antiquated compared to the modern French bikes at the time. And they were laughed at, and they were a bit of a sideshow, really.
our equipment, by contrast with the more advanced bicycles, machines in France, was in absolute stark contrast. We were using what they called a major Taylor stem. It was very much heavier than the was developed in France. And then we found that they were using lighter tyres. They were using a tubular tyre and tube all in one on a stuck on the rim, whereas we had the detachable tyres and tubes. I can remember when our bicycles came out of the box in which they'd been placed for the voyage, and these major Taylor handlebars and these big balloon tyres by comparison with the finer French tubulars were assembled. Cavalier, one of the great French riders, being in absolute convulsions as he saw this equipment coming out. He just couldn't stop laughing. I had the satisfaction in later months of having Cavalier racing alongside me and seeing him in absolute distress, and saying to him, these French tyres go faster than our Australian ones, don't they? And I don't know that he saw the humour of it from his point of view.
When the when Oppie and his team arrived in Europe, there was four riders, but they were supposed to be hooked up with another six riders, French riders. The six riders just never appeared. So really, they were racing in a four-man team against 10-man teams. And in that year, the Tour de France was made up of 20 stages, and most of those stages were team time trials. So as a part of mass starts where the individual can say, if you have a weaker team, you can sort of tap into the strengths of other teams by following the slipstreams of other riders. When other riders make pushes within the bunch, you can sort of try and get well positioned into that slipstream and use a bit of your cunning rather than sheer strength. But in the team time trial, which is really your team against the clock and you go off at separate intervals, you're only as strong as your team is, no matter how strong you are as the individual.
It was an early start for the time trial, the penultimate stage of the Tour de France. Mechanics were up early preparing machines that took to the roads for the big showdown, while the riders themselves were gearing up for some nervous moments on the roads around the town of Saint-Étienne.
It's going to be a big battle and a little piece of pride, I think, for this man, because he is looking to pull back 2 minutes and 12 seconds.
So they were up against it physically from the beginning, and they were taking a bit of a whipping. Towards just before they reached the Pyrenees, for example, there was one stage where Bruce Small, Oppie's manager and the team's manager, they by that point they'd already recruited somebody to act as a translator, and it was fortuitous because the translator overheard one day how there was this one team called Alcyon, who were the big powered number one team that nobody could beat. And he overheard a couple of the team talking about how they were going to take it easy in the team time trial, on this last team time trial before they go into the Pyrenees. And so he relayed this back to Bruce Small, who relayed it back to the riders and said, this could be our opportunity because Alcyon aren't going to ride hard and probably the other teams may not ride so hard, so we could possibly win a stage here.
Pacing in cycling is a very important thing. A rider sitting on a wheel, particularly against the wind, is using probably 5% less energy than he would be if he was out in front making the pace. So with 10 men taking it in turns to make the pace as a team, it's obvious that it's much easier than it is for four, as we were.
And they were doing very, very, very well until the, I think it was about 189-kilometre team time trial, or maybe probably 289 kilometres. And in the last 80 kilometres, out of nowhere, the sponsor's owner out from Alcyon, he arrived to watch his team, and so the Alcyon team had to kick in. It ended up winning the stage, but the Aussies came second. And that was probably the first sort of point where the Aussies sort of showed that, gosh, we may have to reckon with these guys. These are four guys against 10.
to our consternation and the sympathy of the continent, we commenced this system of 14 of these time trial stages, which one of them was 185 miles. And they said we'd be back in Paris in three days. But there is an inspiration in representing your country. There's no question about that. And we resolved that if it's at all humanly possible, we would finish the Tour de France.
Tous les dimanches et souvent les samedis, on se retrouve au bal musette. C'est ce qui fait la joie de notre vie et lui donne un air de fête. Le tango, la rumba.
To finish the tour, the four-man team relied heavily on Oppy's endurance skills and his ability to go through one pain barrier after another without ever cracking. Ray Godkin was the president of Cycling Australia for 15 years and a friend of Oppy. He thinks the cyclist had an almost unique makeup.
There's no doubt about that he was a freak, and there's many sportsmen who there's something special about them, and he was one of those. And to me, what happens when the bodies are made up, there are all certain parts and we've got motors and all sorts of things. He had a big motor. And so he's a freak, and he did things that a normal person couldn't do. And that's the amazing thing. But he did this for, I think, 21 years from when he started as a professional cyclist to when he finished. Four times Australian champion. He won many classics, the big classic in New South Wales. He'd go up into Sydney. He won that twice off the scratch mark. And whenever he rode a classic and things like that, it was just assumed that it was going to be very difficult to beat him, and it was because of this extraordinary makeup that he had within.
5 minutes, 55 seconds is what he lost in the last time trial of the Tour de France last year, although different kind of profile for the event.
A different course. He's a different man, that's for sure. He finished 14th in the Tour last year. Here he is riding out the start house, sitting in third position, and Paris on the horizon.
Yeah, I've said on many occasions that having ridden this particular event, the Tour de France, the 3,300 miles as it was then and lasting a month, and with roads which I estimated afterwards only had 500 miles of reasonable bitumen, the rest being metalled, gravel or cobblestone roads, and the mountains, and the Pyrenees with their 7,000 feet high, and the Alps, and others, climbs that are famous or notorious for their difficulties. Having completed that event, I said that I would never be afraid of any distance or of any event, providing that I'd been properly prepared for it beforehand, because it would be impossible to go through more physical fatigue and exhaustion than we experienced in that particular race. Undoubtedly, had we known what we were going to face with this system, I don't think we'd have started. But it's one of the confirmations that ignorance is bliss, and each day we managed to stagger through, excepting for Bainbridge, who 10 years older was really too old for the Tour de France. He'd broken out in boils and he had several falls and he was forced out of the event.
We are on the climb now and the field at the back is paying for the early pace. They are splitting up here, but look at this. This is the main field fragmenting here psychologically as well. Just over a kilometre to go to the summit.
We've been in the saddle today for almost 4 hours and 52 minutes. That's a long day when you bear in mind, I think, we're still looking at around about an hour to go to the end.
Oppy ended up finishing 18th overall in that first tour. And that probably laid the foundations to his popularity. But it was just after that year's tour, he competed in a track event called the Bol d'Or in Paris.
It was non-stop from the time that you started. Whatever happened, your laps were deducted against you. And that was it. You just faced 24 hours of as much continuous riding as you could carry out. We started at 11 o'clock at night. And the first hour or so was quite steady, and then a jam occurred with the field split up and somebody trying to break away, and I'd got out of my saddle to get greater pace to jump in a greater speed, and the chain snapped, and so I got onto my spare bike straight away, lost three or four laps, and then the chain snapped on that, and it was later found that they'd been filed through to paper thickness so that when that extra strain was, that extra pressure was placed on the pedals, that the chains would go, and of course you'd lose laps on the changeover. So here I was with two bikes out of action. So I grabbed a bicycle that was on the side of the track, mud guards and lamp on it, roadster bike, and was losing one lap out of every seven as the field went round. The French crowd were incensed at the fact that someone had sabotaged my machines, and they gave voice to that in no uncertain terms. They just hurled abuse at the field every time it lapped me. That didn't alter the fact that by the time I'd got the chains fixed, that I was 17 laps behind, and on a three-lap track, that was almost 6 miles. I persisted. I had no thought of pulling out. Well, I was laps down there, and the law of nature was calling on to me. But I had more packed velodrome of anything, 30,000 people possibly, who were looking, who were watching me. And then, to their astonishment, they saw this long silvery stream on the track, and the howls of protest from the riders who were following. But I can say this, that whatever records I've broken, whatever records I've made, and even though they have been broken, there's one record that will never be broken, and that is that I have been cheered by thousands of people for having urinated in front of them.
He ended up winning the event, and I think when he finished the event, he had completed like 906 kilometres. The crowd were cheering L.A. Oppy, and what they wanted him to do was to go for the 1,000 kilometre record. I mean, he'd got off his bike, he was exhausted, he'd won, he'd come back from having his bike sabotaged, he'd fought furiously alone to chase the leaders, and they wanted more. And the fact they wanted more, that was the whole velodrome, the crowd there was just cheering, L.A. Oppy.
Bruce had been calling out to me for the track, "You're ahead of the 1,000 miles kilometre record, world's kilometre record. How about going on for the 24 hours, for the 1,000 kilometres? And I was, by that time, I'd had it. I had no desire to go on for 1,000 kilometres. And so when the gun went, I stopped, and he came up and held me and said, "Well, what about the 1,000 kilometres? I said, "No, it's not on." He said, "Look, I know you, and you've got enough left to do the 1,000. It'll never be forgotten if you continue on, and tomorrow you won't be any more tired than you are now. It won't make the slightest difference to you." I protested for a couple of minutes, and then the old track manager, Seymour, came over, and he had tears running down his cheeks, and he said, "You keep going, Oppy, keep going." And the crowd took up the chant of "Oppy, Oppy, Opperman, Ali Vazi, Ali, 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 Ali Vazi, keep going." So they pushed me off. Of course, all the other riders went off the track. And with the track to myself, no having to go up the bank and around the other riders, The night air was beautifully crisp by then. The humidity, of course, had gone out of the night. And the hour and 19 minutes just passed like a flash. And I got the 1,000-kilometre record. And that established me finally in France. They called me the phenomenon and all of the eulogistic things that they heap on you at that time.
The French just embraced him, and it wasn't just France that embraced him. The French newspaper that then owned the race and the Tour de France and who created the Tour, the French newspaper L'Auto, did a poll, and he was voted as not just the French Sportsman of the Year for that year, but European Sportsman of the Year. And no Australian since has ever been European Sportsman of the Year. And really, that etched his name as a superhero, not just as a great, talented cyclist or a Tour de France hero. He was right up there with the very greatest, in that year, the greatest sportsman of them all, more than the Davis Cup stars of France, more than the footballers. He'd etched his name, and he came back to Australia. He went away as a very good cyclist. He came back as a super god, although Australia probably didn't realise it at the time.
Offerman returned to Australia and a hero's welcome. In his particular endeavour, he was in the same league as Bradman, the consummate athlete, almost impossible to beat. I asked his son Ian how his time in Europe had changed him.
He was a different person. He used to wear a beret all the time. It was his trademark, very French. When he was a Member of Parliament, he rode around on a Vespa. Now, that was unheard of. He was the first one to drive a Goggomobile. You know, like he had this difference. I knew he was different to other people, and it was... And he could speak French too. He taught himself how to converse in France. It was a little bit different to... And this is a fellow who had very little education, so to speak. He just taught himself through life's ways. I mean, one of his passions was ballet, which was really different, but he used to feel that that was one of the most strenuous physical sports, so to speak, of all time. You know, when people used to speak to me about Dad, that they saw him riding in France and in Germany and in Britain and Ireland, and they just said he was a magnificent athlete. He had a passion to ride, and that was basically it. But there was one thing I always knew about my father. He had a fabulous sense of humour. Absolutely fabulous. He used to love the goons. He used to get right into them. They make us sit around the wireless and listen to the goons, and we'd just all have a belly laugh over it. And it was nice. But he had an impish sense of humour. It was great.
Dear Grand Selectal, sit down on this fossilised shooting stick.
Ooh.
That's an old gag, but a new stick. Well done. Thank you, my good man.
This is the story of Sir Hubert Opperman, today on Radio National's Hindsight. Back in Australia, Oppie was showing no signs of settling down to a quiet family life with his wife Mavis. But there are always new records to be broken, and for the next 3 years, he spent most of his time cycling from one end of the country to the other, for the most part, setting new world records. But the Tour de France was never too far from his mind. Rupert Guinness again.
The 1931 tour, so it was 3 years since Oppie had been back to France, and he sort of continued on etching his name in Australia by doing a lot of records in Australia, point-to-point records, and he certainly became a very good, obviously, long-distance cyclist. I guess we saw that in his first tour in 1928. I mean, endurance was not a problem for Oppie. He went back to France for the 1931 tour. I guess by that point he'd had the experience of knowing what the tour was all about. He knew he could compete in it, even against the odds. He would have known that if we can get a team together which is stronger than four people, our chances are much, much better. They still had the problem of actually getting 10 Australian riders together. They couldn't get that. They got he went over with three Australians and a New Zealand rider, and they joined up with it was going to be a similar agreement to join up this time with some Swiss riders. At least the Swiss riders turned up this time, so they did have a 10-man team.
The last circuit of the Tour de France here on the Champs-Élysées. The bell rings, 6.5 kilometres to go, and everybody is scrabbling for wheels here. He's got up to the leaders now. The sprinters are trying to organise at the back.
Well, Engie's trying to organise himself here for the win of the stage, but looking back, you can see they've got a slight advantage. Panic on board in the streets of the sprinters.
Because he rode a very, very good tour that year. He got as high as sixth place overall on stage 14 of 22. And then it was just going into the Alps. You know, they've got through the Pyrenees and going into the Alps that he came down with dysentery. And even today, there's a lot of riders who come down with the same ailments, and one bad day in the saddle, trying to overcome a condition like that, a lot of them just don't finish. I think Oppy persevered, and he dropped to 18th place overall from six. That would have been not just a physical blow, it would have been a big blow to your morale. And then he managed to still persevere. And the thing that sort of inspired him was that Bruce Small, who was as much a part of the Oppy story as Oppy was himself, Bruce was in a photographer's car, and that car went over a ravine in the mountains. Fortunately, Bruce managed to jump out of the car just before it went down. But one of the French star riders, André Leduc, he passed Oppy on one of the descents and just said, look, by the way, you know, Bruce, he was in the car that had this horrible accident. And the news of that absolutely shocked Oppy, and he thought, you know, Bruce had been killed. And he's still riding his bike, trying to work out, you know, he was going to abandon the tour because of his distress over Bruce Small's supposed crash. And until suddenly he turned the corner and there was Bruce Small doing what he does best and yelling, "L.A. Oppy." Well, he wasn't saying "L.A. Oppy," he was saying, you know, probably something a bit more forthright, you know, like get your rear end up the road quick. And that inspired Oppy, and he dug in and he rode and he got himself back up to 12th place by the end of that year's tour. And it was a remarkable effort, which stood as the best performance by an Australian in the Tour de France for the next up until 1982, when Phil Anderson came fifth.
That was Oppy's last attempt at winning the Tour de France, though he did compete in several European cycle classics and won what many see as his greatest race, the 726-mile Paris-Brest-Paris in torrential rain, in a time of 49 hours and 21 minutes. To his list of records, he added the Land's End to John O'Groats, the Belfast to Dublin, and the London Bath London. But there was one record back home he still wanted, the ride across Australia. And so in 1933, he travelled to Western Australia to attempt to beat the Perth to Sydney record, at that time held by Billy Reid, at 18 days, 18 hours.
I dipped the rear wheel of the bicycle in the Indian Ocean, which was considered symbolic impetus for the front wheel to arrive at the Pacific. I cut through, went to Kalgoorlie, arrived at Kalgoorlie, and then went on to Xanthus and cut through onto the Nullarbor Plains at Xanthus. One night I was riding on a sinuous sandy road, in deep ruts, and with the car right up behind me, probably only 10 yards behind, to give me the maximum of light as I came around the bend. If they're any further back, I'd be left in darkness and could have skidded over, and it would have been dangerous for them to come around. And then in the lights, I saw this coiled up snake with his head in the air, tongue poking out in the brief glimpse I had of him, and with his head darting all over the place. I had bare legs, and I had to make up my mind if I'd hit the brakes, I'd have skidded to a stop, and the motor car would have been over the top of me, I'm sure of that, and the alternative was to run over the snake. Well, I lifted the front wheel, sat back, lifted the front wheel, and I bashed it down on the snake as hard as I could, and then lifted my tail off the seat and then whacked it down on it as well. And they never even saw the snake. They must have run over it, but I guess it was dispatched with the with the four wheels running over it anyhow. But I could feel snakes crawling up my legs for the next couple of hours. Another day, I'd gone ahead on a well-defined trail, and the biggest dingo is as big as an Alsatian trotted across the road in front of me. And then it was just one monotonous plug against the headwind weaving in and out of the telegraph poles, the famous Eucla line. There was 110 in the shade at Eucla, and I had a sleep off during the afternoon to wait for the bit of cool from the evening. I had the Nanwara sands to contend with there then. It was possible you could get into the sandy periods, yes, the very sandy areas, in the early morning, because the dew is so heavy that it actually was binding the sand, and you'd get miles and miles of riding that otherwise would be impossible later in the day when it lost this binding effect. But it was impossible with the Nanwara sands, so I hit them in the daytime, and it was a case of just putting the bike on the shoulder, and I was walking for 10 miles. And as I'd been not walking for at least a week, the walking muscles had fallen into some disuse, and I was sore for a couple of days afterwards. When I got off the bike, I could feel the soreness of the walking muscles. But in essence, the ride was over when I got to Port Augusta, because from then on, it was asphalt road all the way to Sydney. And one knew that you could make efforts and perhaps get fatigued, and the bike would still run if you had to walk up the hills, which never happened. But if you had to walk up the hills, you could still freewheel down and the bike would run. Whereas back on the Nullarbor Plains and amongst the sand, it was a case of the bike never ran on its own. You had to keep pushing it all the time.
Oppie eventually made it to Sydney's Martin Place at 10:51 p.m. in a time of 13 days, 10 hours and 21 minutes, beating Billy Reid's record by 5 days, 8 hours. At 35, he joined the RAAF as an air craftsman. He became a physical training and drill instructor and finished the war with the rank of flight lieutenant. After he was demobbed, he returned to Malvern Star Cycles in the position of director in charge of public relations.
What he did outside of Europe, when he went to the UK and he broke the record from Land's End to John O'Groats, and he didn't just beat it, he absolutely hammered it. And then he went over and he won the Tour of Ireland. There were lots of things there that, I mean, when he finished after the war, and in 1946, he decided to come back into cycling one more time. And he rode at the Sydney Velodrome, and in 24 hours broke 101 records. Now, that's pretty phenomenal when you think of it. And that, I think, is indicative of what he was like. And then he just said, right, I'm finished up, finished now, and he did.
You're like an old tyre. The difference between a new tube and an old one, you blow up a new one until it'll remain inflated. You blow up an old one and you get the pressure, but you don't know how long it's going to last. And so I decided, and rightly so, to retire in 1946.
You're listening to the story of Sir Hubert Opperman on ABC Radio National's Hindsight. Retirement may well have been the end of Oppie's public life, but with his high profile as a champion sportsman, it wasn't too long before a political party came calling. Ian Hancock is a historian of the Liberal Party.
The first important thing to remember about Opperman when he stands for pre-selection is that he does have what the Liberal Party then called a trifecta, would have called a trifecta. That is, he was a sporting hero, he was married with a child and had a service record. When he went for pre-selection, there were 101 pre-selectors and he won 52 votes. In fact, the man who stood for the Liberal Party in the seat in 1946 only managed 5. Menzies was not terribly impressed when Opperman won pre-selection. He was reported to have remarked, "Oh dear, we've got a mere bike rider standing in Corio." When he stood against Dedman, he organised a brilliant campaign, some 49 public meetings. There were meetings of 8 people on one occasion and 1,000 on another. The electorate was flooded with senior Liberals, young Liberals in the women's section. And one of the main points that Opperman had as he used to ride around the electorate on his bike was to make the point that Dedman, his opponent, who was a senior minister in the Chifley Labour government, was in fact a dedicated socialist and a joyless doer Scot who was going to bring horror to one's lives because he wasn't going to allow people to buy their own houses. He remarked on a previous occasion, this was Dedman, that the Labour government was not in the business of letting people own their own homes and becoming little capitalists. He was able to capitalise, as it were, on that particular theme, and he just scraped home.
He won by 220 votes, very tight. And the next 3 years, he spent a lot of time in Canberra, and Dedman stood against him for the next election, and he only made it by 180 votes. And at that time, he said, "That is the last time I will stay away from my area. I'll put more time in." And from then on, he increased his majority.
In 1963, the Labour Party put up Bob Hawke, thinking that the Wonder Boy, as Opperman once called him, would take Corio back for the Labour Party, because it should be, and it's, of course has since been, a natural Labour seat with the expansion of Geelong. Hawke was put in there as a candidate. Over £20,000 was reputedly spent on the campaign. All the heavies went down there, a massive advertising campaign, and Opperman beat him by some 3,000 votes. And enjoyed writing about it later. I told one of the Victorian Liberals that the hawk had been reduced to a squawk, and he also said the bird got the bird. He enjoyed that victory more than, perhaps even more than beating Dedman. Because the Labour Party put in such a strong campaign to unseat him, and he was thought to be not a particularly, the level of intelligence or indeed educational background of Bob Hawke, it was the competition between the bright young thing of the future and this rather older man now, who was admittedly a minister for shipping and transport in the Menzies government, but not a particularly outstanding figure in politics. It was clearly marked out as a campaign that Labour thought it could win, and the Liberals really did think that Opperman was going to be in trouble.
It is really a very remarkable victory. Of course, I would be deceiving myself and you if I said that I didn't expect to win. But in my best moments, I thought...
After the 1963 election, Opperman, who had been Minister for Shipping and Transport, was moved to Immigration, not in the Cabinet, but in the Outer Ministry still. When he was appointed to this position, Peter Howson, who was a backbench Liberal who expected himself to be promoted, remarked in his diary that Opperman would be hopeless in this position. In fact, Opperman wasn't hopeless. He organised one of the most important breaches in the White Australia policy. He came to Cabinet in 1964 with a proposal for change, which was rejected largely because Menzies spoke so forcibly against it.
Mr Opperman, member for Corio and the government whip, speaking on the budget on the 27th of August.
Now, before I speak on this first budget, Mr. Bowles...
When you take over a department, you do so because you're so strange to it that you're prepared for the time being to let everything ride. And then as you get hold of it, there are cases come up that make you quite concerned, and you feel that despite precedent, that it's not right. And I think one of the things that really disturbed me was the we had a 15 years residence in Australia for Chinese before they could be naturalised, and it was 5 years for others. It was for Asians, not Chinese, for Asians. And the case that hit me, though, was the Chinese student that had kept on, and they're both Chinese, that's right, they're students, and they married. and they had a little girl. She was, I think, 6 years of age. She couldn't speak Chinese, and they'd grooved into the community. And here we've got a situation where these Chinese people, instead of having their baby in their own country and being brought up, she's been brought up in Australia. Now, they go back to Hong Kong, that girl is going to be completely out of her depth. She's Australian, and they're Australians, to my mind. So I fell back on my ministerial powers and let them remain in Australia, knowing that I was creating a precedent that could jump up and hit me with somebody else that we didn't want to stop it. But that got me on the track, and the department agreed with me. They were glad to see I was taking that step. We fought it, and finally got it to a submission, and the cabinet threw it out the first time, but it was close. I knew it was close.
He came back in 1966 when Holt was Prime Minister, and the cabinet eventually agreed to his proposal, which amounted to this, that if Asians or non-Europeans, as we're generally referred to, non-Europeans could come into Australia on a temporary residence permit if they were considered to be the right kind of people to fit into the society, and after 5 years could apply for permanent residence and for citizenship had they remained for 5 years. Those who were already in Australia could apply after 5 years of having been here for residency and citizenship, and moreover could bring their families with them under a family reunion scheme. These proposals went through Cabinet, despite the fact that there were many people in the Cabinet who were concerned about this was opening the door and you'd never be able to shut it again. Opperman, by this particular move, with the support obviously of the Department of Immigration, did actually organise a significant breach in the White Australia policy, and he did so, interestingly, in 1966, the year after the Labor Party had finally dropped the maintenance of White Australia from its platform. And there were many Labor speakers in the debate on this proposal who made it very clear they were very unhappy about this change. They saw it, quite rightly, as a significant breach. Opperman is often forgotten of having been responsible for that breach.
Politics is fickle, and among the endless cut and thrust of a parliament's life, it's understandable that Oppie's greatest contribution has been forgotten. However, one would have thought that his cycling achievements would have placed his name among the very best that Sporting Australia has to offer. Yet mention his name, and most people think of Oppenheimer, the father of the atom bomb. Oppie even has a theory as to why he was forgotten.
Years ago, he said to me, look, in the 20s and 30s, look, there was Bradman, there was Lindrum, and there was Opperman. And then along came a horse called Farlap, and that was the end of Opperman. And I think that's fairly true. I really do. I think a horse was the one that brushed Dad off the... It amazes me over a period of time for what he's done to be the only non-European to have won the Bol d'Or, to me, is amazing. He's more popular in Europe than he is in Australia, and that astounds me, because in 1931 he went and rode in the Paris to Brest of Paris, which is held only every 10 years because it's the toughest ride of 1,400 kilometres non-stop, and he's the only non-European to have ever won it. They invited him back in 1991 to the centenary of the Paris to Brest of Paris, and it was held in the square at in Paris, and there was 100,000 people there to greet him. Now, Chirac handed him the gold key to Paris. So that is how they adored him and how they... it mystifies me that Dad really hasn't had that tilted fame here than he had in Europe.
After 18 years of politics, Oppie retired, and he ended his career as the High Commissioner to Malta. While he was knighted in 1968, his name may never be as well known as Bradman, Farlap, or even Thorpe. Ian Anderson helped to set up the Opperman Museum in Oppie's birthplace of Rochester. The museum was opened in 1994 on the cyclist's 90th birthday, and it was the last time Oppie rode a bike.
The bike that you see over there is actually the bike that Oppie rode for years and years after he retired from bike riding.
Right.
But unfortunately, he had a bit of an altercation with a bus. So he promised Lady Mavis that on his 90th birthday, he would retire from riding. So that's another thing that happened, that we picked his 90th birthday to unveil a statue. And what he did is he said he would ride around the streets of Rochester for his last ride. Now, I suppose I didn't give it much thought, and I should have realised what this last ride meant to Oppie, because, let's be honest, bike riding was his heart and soul. Mm. And a few people who thought they knew better than Sir Hubert and myself suggested that how about if he just does it for about 100 metres, because after all, he's a man of 90 and we didn't want him to fall off. And there were people everywhere, and I think we had well over 5,000 people here that day. Well, he took off and he went straight past the waiting media and he went around the block, went down the main street of Rochester, because he said he wanted to do this, and we were all looking aghast. But of course, the man could ride regardless if he was 90 or not. And when he came back, he presented the bike to the museum, and he had tears in his eyes. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until then that I realised what a big moment this meant for Oppie.
While Oppie might have stopped riding, there was a whole new generation of racing cyclists keen to read about and meet the legends of the sport. One of these was a young Gold Coast rider called Robbie McEwen.
I was lucky enough to meet him back in the early 90s. He was up on the Gold Coast, and back then he signed a picture for me and I had a chat to him, and I obviously don't know everything about his life, but what I do know, I find impressive, and I have great respect for it. To be the one that started it all off, and it's his footsteps that all Australians have followed in since. Someone's got to be the first, and he was it.
McEwen eventually followed in Oppie's footsteps, and in this year's Tour de France, he won the coveted green jersey for best sprinter, for the third time in his cycling career. While Sir Hubert Opperman mightn't be a household name, among those who do know of him, there is a feeling that there is more to be learnt from his life than simply listing the records he created or broke. We'll give Rupert Guinness the last word.
Oppie's legacy, as I see it, is his spirit and his nature of just not giving up. And he had so many barriers in front of him, but he overcame them all. While he may not have ever won the Tour de France, for example, but he still rode some excellent, excellent races. And he allowed a spirit, a combativeness of the Australian rider, that spirit to blossom. And that's really what the mission of riders in the future, when they went over to compete in Europe, and still to this day, to go over to Europe as part of this big adventure to test yourself and to improve yourself, not just as a cyclist, but as a person. And we saw with Oppie's career later on, he proved that he was a hard toiler and a very intelligent person, because he was intelligent with his racing, you know, his career in politics. And the fact, to the very night that he died in April 1996, you know, he was riding on his home trainer and his heart failed. He got everything out of his life, and it was one great adventure. And for Australians, I think, you know, if non-cyclists were able to tap into the story of Oppie Moore, you'd get a lot of inspiration as to what you can fit into one life, and for a lot of good.
You've been listening to Hindsight and Alle Oppie. Thanks to the National Library for the use of their interviews with Hubert Opperman and to Michelle Rayner. Technical production was by Louis Mitchell, and it was produced by Martin Hewitson. We've got details of books about Oppie on our website, and you can also download a podcast of the program there at abc.net.au and just look for Hindsight.
A ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.